morning, everybody, and a warm welcome to the latest Original Thinkers podcast here at Alliance Manchester Business School. I'm Jim Pentrell, I'm Research Communications Lead here at the school. But today I'm delighted to be joined by a very esteemed panel to talk about PROTECT, which was a major COVID-19 study into the transmission of the virus, and then the environment in terms of the wider UK research programme around COVID-19. And I'm joined on my right by Professor David Fishwick, who is Chief Medical Advisor for the Health and Safety Executive GB. To my left is Professor Sheila Johnson, who is Professor of Work Psychology and Wellbeing here at the Business School. And also by Professor Marty van Tongeren, who is Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health here at the University of Manchester. Welcome everybody. So first of all, just before we start, just tell us a little bit about the, to introduce yourselves first of all, a little bit about yourselves, and we'll talk about more depth about the study. David.
Thanks, Jim. Well, good morning as well. My name's David Fishwick. I've got a very unusual job. I've spent my life as a clinician in the NHS. I've been an adult respiratory physician looking after people who've got sick because of workplace exposures. And throughout that professional time, I've also been the Chief Medical Advisor for the Health and Safety Executive, both in GB and in Northern Ireland. So I get involved in a lot of research and a lot of policy advice and a lot of regulatory activities all around keeping workers safe in GB.
And in terms of your relationship with Business School and University here, have you been working in the school for many years?
Yeah, I've got a really long-standing association with Marty, but also in my semi-retirement plan, I've also got a paid day a week of employment in Marty's department.
Okay. Sheena.
Hi, good morning, Jim. I'm Sheena Johnson, Professor of Work Psychology and Wellbeing. I'm based in the Alliance Manchester Business School here. My research really focuses on health and wellbeing in the workplace. So obviously the COVID situation was particularly relevant to that. And I'm associated with the Thomas Ashton Institute and the Work Inequalities Institute.
Marty.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. And my name is Marty van Tongeren. I work at the School of Health Sciences within the University of Manchester. My background is I'm a exposure scientist, epidemiologist. So my research is really about trying to understand better the occupational and environmental determinants of health, which can then be used to try to develop interventions and policy interventions or interventions in the workplace to improve health of workers and the general population.
Great.
And I'm also attached to the Thomas Ashton Institute as well.
Okay. Great. Okay. David, could I just turn to you first?
Sure.
I'll sort of start of a turn, if you like. Tell us a little bit about the PROTECT study. This is a major government study. Tell us a little bit more about it. When did it start? Who was involved? And what role did Manchester play particularly?
So I'll probably ask Marty to talk about the Manchester context, but I think people realised immediately when the pandemic hit that something needed to be done urgently in many domains of research to help us through this dreadful time, in a sense. And the Chief Scientific Advisors Network, which was then headed by Sir Patrick Vallance, was also attended by our Chief Scientific Advisor, Professor Andrew Curran from HSE. So there were a set of, you know, effectively core national studies that were brigaded together extremely quickly, and in my personal view, extremely impressively, to deal with this. And PROTECT is thus one of those national core studies. And it particularly deals with the transmission of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, particularly with a focus on the workplace. How does it transmit? How do we prevent it transmitting? And all the science that hangs off that. So that's how that study started. And there were many players and many researchers across the country involved, but Manchester had a very important role in this.
So I was approached by Professor Andrew Curran probably over the summer of 2020, so fairly early during the pandemic, with almost an invitation to kind of say, are you interested to join this consortium of researchers and scientists to help develop and lead this PROTECT project? So I jumped at that. I think I was very, very keen. And he asked me to lead a theme within that PROTECT project, which was about kind of looking at sectors. So he asked me whether I could lead an area of research really to to do deep dive into sectors. So we looked at the public transport sector, we looked at the construction sector, we looked at retail, we looked at various kind of sectors to try to understand how they addressed the pandemic, what interventions they implemented, what they found worked well, what they found that didn't work well. And that was part of the study. So we applied a kind of mixed methods approaches. So we used qualitative researchers, quantitative researchers, researchers from FSE, from humanities, from FBMH, the different faculties, from the university, so with a different background in disciplines, to come together to try to work on that project. So we've done loads of work in this area, and it was extremely fascinating. And we worked with, Office of National Statistics to kind of analyze data to see how the transmission and the impact of the transmission varied between different sectors. And there was also kind of a number of spin-off projects that we were asked to do, because one of the intriguing things about Protect was that it didn't start like a normal project. Normal project, you have a really long detailed written protocol, you have work programs that are reasonably well planned, and you follow them. This we started really with an empty page, and we developed that as we were going along, and it was very reactive and adaptive. So at some point we were asked to look at an issue that was really kind of interesting, that became apparent that certain areas of the country were always at the highest level of infections. And there were some in the Northwest, the Northeast, and the East Midlands. And in fact, we asked then Sheena to kind of help us and trying to develop a project that aimed to understand why that was. And maybe Sheena, you can talk a little bit more about that work, and also the work that then followed on in terms of Greater Manchester.
Sure, absolutely. So as Marty said, I got involved with the Protect study kind of later on in 2020. So I think me and Marty already knew each other. We'd done a little bit of work together previously. So I got involved at that stage. I think we were looking at the construction and the public transport at that point. And then in 2021, there was a SAGE report that identified these areas of enduring prevalence, as they termed it in that report. And we were really approached, weren't we, to say, could we take a focus on this? And as Marty said, that blank page approach, this is an issue that's come up, can we focus on this? And I was asked to kind of take a lead on looking at that. So during 2021, later on, I think we did this around July, November time, we conducted a number of interviews with directors of public health in different regions across the UK, and we looked at both areas of enduring prevalence and comparison areas, really with a view to try and see what were the potential kind of drivers for these differences. So that was done, and we identified a few things.
I guess a challenge straight away here was you were conducting this research, but it was moving. The whole situation was moving extremely quickly. We were living in an extraordinary time where things were moving very quickly. That must have been a big challenge when you came to actually trying to do the everyday research when you got this, the whole.
It was a challenge, but it also offered opportunities, I think, because I think certainly with things like the Enduring Prevalence Project, we were talking to people who really wanted to contribute, so they were very keen, more keen than most research projects maybe, to be involved, because there was like this huge collective effort to try and find as many answers as we could in a short space of time. So challenging, yes, but exciting, yes, and lots of opportunities as well. And it was rapid, so we were moving at speed to both kind of identify the kind of research questions that we wanted to look at, and we were consulting with the HSE and with UKHSA and so on, and really kind of having that collaborative approach to what we were trying to achieve, then reaching out to the research participants. In this case, it was the directors of public health. They engaged brilliantly well, which was really good. And we conducted a series of interviews with them.
Well, it was almost like real time research, wasn't it? Yeah. I guess you were, and were you actually advising these senior people and medical people across the country almost?
Of course, I guess, Jim, the term co-creation gets used a lot, perhaps inappropriately, but this was truly co-creating what we were doing, as you say, literally almost day by day, because things would change. So we were reaching out, as Sheena said, to a lot of individual stakeholders and actually working with them and trying to preempt where the virus was going next and how the pandemic may look. And yes, of course, and we'll talk about it maybe a little bit later on, HSE was, like a lot of government departments, feeding off the research outputs in real time. They weren't waiting for the final beautifully produced paper in a peer review publication. We were having multiple meetings all the way through to start feeding urgent outputs through to people who wanted to use them.
Perhaps come back later to that point, actually, about, have things gone back to, all those sort of lessons, or that way of working, would it maybe?
I suspect we're all changed forever.
We'll come back. Obviously, we haven't talked about the findings, actually, what you found. Yeah. And just briefly, because I'm sure, obviously, it's extensive and complex, but Marty, just briefly, what were the key things that came out?
The key things, well, I mean, there's a whole area of findings that were supported or developed by the Protect project, and a number of those weren't really in my area or our area of research that identified effectiveness of certain control measures such as masks and air purifiers that supported the reduction of the virus in the air. That was done by other people within the Protect project. Some of them were also less effective or not so effective. What we kind of found really as part of our research was that and I think it was already kind of alluded to, there was an enormous effort by various different sectors to come together and actually be quite collaborative. And I think within, for example, the public transport, we saw at least at the start, a really strong collaboration between unions, between the employers, between the regulators, all coming together and really kind of trying to, basically deal with this problem really collaboratively. And that was quite an eye opener, I think, and really constructive. And I think we also found that there was some kind of difference in perceptions. One of the interesting things I think that perhaps Sheena can also kind of explain, but what we found in some of the project was that, especially in public transport, everyone was keen to kind of like keep the risk mitigations going for quite a long time. But actually, when then suddenly the government said, well, we don't need them anymore, there was actually quite a rapid reduction in the use of certain kind of risk management measures. So masks are rarely used, I think, in the UK now these days. And that was a little bit of a surprise because we kind of thought that may be a longer duration. But the other kind of area of work that we did, we did a lot of work in is around the analysis of some of the statistics that we're collecting. And David and I had various interesting discussions about what those results mean. But we do find that the risks, or at least the relative risks in transmissions and risk of infection and the risk of mortality, differed by different workplaces and different occupations. And initially that is clearly understandable because a lot of people were essential workers, had to go out of the house and had to do kind of, go to work, while many of us could just work from, the confines of our own home. And clearly that has a lot of risk, a lot of less risk. But that changed over the pandemic because we kind of obviously more and more went back to work, but also did other things like went to the pub and went to restaurants and concerts and all these kind of things happened. So that pattern kind of changed over time. So whilst we saw initially that many of the essential workers had an increased risk in infection and mortality compared to the non-essential workers, with healthcare workers clearly one of the group with the highest relative risk. interestingly, that changed over the pandemic. So the healthcare workers in the later part weren't necessarily at an increased risk as, for example, teachers were, because they in the second part or the third part of the pandemic stayed at relatively high risk of infections. So there were these kind of interesting patterns that you could identify between occupations.
Mm. I was going to come in on that, but also what I think is important here is lessons learned, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the immediate crisis is over, but there's a fantastic legacy of research and work's been done. So how can that be relevant for the future? I suppose that would be a really important point to talk about here. Just what Marsh is saying there, different sectors seem to be having, there were different research data coming back. What are we going to do with this information now?
What do we do with it going forward? I mean, there's a huge amount of information there. So, the way in which we apply it in the future will depend on the situation. I think one of the key things that came out of all of the research was this partnership work and this idea that either within sectors or across different agencies, health agencies and so on, this kind of rapid change in the way that we worked and the way in which we shared information, shared data, and bringing together collaborations of people to kind of have task forces looking at particular things. This is something the directors of public health talked about, but also representatives in different sectors talked about. I think that's really important to try and retain that. There is a risk, I think, that some of it can be lost. And I think that'd be a real shame, because I think everyone that we've spoken to has kind of exclusively said that has made such a difference in the preparedness to deal with a rapidly changing situation. So I would hope in the future, if we were faced with either another COVID breakout or some other kind of emergency, that we would be better equipped to kind of have those teams in place to be able to rapidly address it.
If I could add, Jim, I think from our perspective, my perspective personally, I think we all knew before the pandemic that work is complicated. We now know that work is complicated.
Yeah.
A doctor or a nurse is a word, but actually what those individuals do are hugely different. Mm. So work is not a thing, but it's a set of complicated interconnected tasks. And all of us in the room in this conversation here are going to be doing workplace research in the future.
Mm.
And we may approach workplace research, particularly if we're looking at work as a risk factor for something like a viral transmission. I think we'll do it differently.
Yeah.
And we'll realise that transmission is actually a continuous risk from when you leave the house to when you get back home at the end of your workday, and you still have that risk when you're at home also.
Mm-hmm.
And we're thinking about things, I think, very differently now.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting things that was done with Protect was that from the start, we developed this logo, and it was environment, it was the virus, and it was the human, and that interplay between those kind of different factors really determined the risk of infection and disease and mortality. So having that strong interdisciplinary kind of nature really kind of was really kind of developed and put into place in that project really strongly. From we all work in interdisciplinary research, but often it's not as interdisciplinary as it should be. This was really truly highly interdisciplinary, and I think that's one of the legacies that we need to have. If we have problems like the infection or mental health, for example, that really covers a different areas and involves environmental risk factor, work risk factors, individual risk factors, understanding about the mechanisms, all of that need to be taken together to really solve a problem.
David, I was going to pick up on something there. I mean, the fact that companies now, organisations, I'm presuming now look at this very differently to 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, in terms of the risks in the workplace. Has there been a sort of a complete mindset change here in terms of how companies approach these kind of issues, would you say?
Yeah, I suspect there has been. I suspect, as in real life, there are always going to be situations where workplaces are doing fantastically well, and there are going to be others where they can improve practice. And I suspect that the pandemic did focus the workplace's mind basically on keeping their workers safe. And I'm not saying that in any cynical way, because I truly believe it. What we saw was a strengthening of the relationship between the employer and the employee.
And that's what I was
but actually, you might have thought it might have become a bit more fragile or a bit more disconnected, or or the workplace isn't worried about
mental
health.
I just point is that organizations, organizations always, number one, keep employees safe.
Yeah,
course.
But it actually genuinely, I picked up on, and I think a lot of my colleagues in HSC and beyond did pick up on this.
There were exceptions to that
as
well, obviously, as David's already alluded to. So something that came out of the enduring prevalence work was like the nature of work, whether people, what type of work people were involved in, the type of support that they received from their employers. Some were fantastic. Most, I think, were very good, but some less good, you know, so in assisting people to maybe isolate if required, maybe having working conditions that are quite precarious, which means that people are less likely to test because they, you know, they test, they have to isolate, they don't get paid. It's linked to deprivation, it's linked to kind of wider structural issues. I find that really quite interesting to look at. So on the whole, I agree, you know, companies, organisations were very, very good on the whole, but there were pockets where they were less so.
What the question really is the sustainability of that and how long that will be sustained. And I don't know that. I mean, I think the jury is out on that. I think how long these kind of lessons are maintained and how long, you know, we also see that quite quickly after the pandemic, other priorities came into play, like, you know, that meant that for, particularly in terms of the directors of public health, you know, they suddenly were asked to concentrate on the fuel crisis and the cost of living crisis that, you know, perhaps kind of, you know, took some of that, you know, energy and efforts away in relation to the pandemic. Although, as you all know, the kind of the people who are living in deprived areas and this, and what Sheen also found is structural kind of issues in terms of deprivation also play a very important role in terms of the
pandemic. Alluded to it earlier about we saw this kind of quite rapid shift back, you know, so we were told for the first year or two of the studies that people expected these mitigations and so on to be in place for a long time, and then over the last year they went very rapidly. That, as a follow-up to the enduring prevalence study, we did a Greater Manchester focus study. And part of that, we did a survey of employers and employees, and we did additional interviews with public health and environmental health teams. And what came out of that really was that most mitigations have been dropped very rapidly, which at the moment is not a bad thing, maybe, you know, because we didn't see a subsequent big wave of COVID like we had in preceding years, but it does indicate that there's this kind of return to normal.
I'm just gonna ask about that place element and the fact that you began to look at it in more depth in Greater Manchester, what was happening. Was that sort of a deviation from the original plan of the research, or
it was kind of a follow-on, wasn't it, from the enduring prevalence? I think it was kind of guided by HSE and UKHSA, I think. Was that right?
It was guided, but we also kind of thought, well, it'd be useful to, because initially the enduring prevalence was, we interviewed only directors of public health, and we wanted to kind of extend that to also interview kind of business leaders, employees, and to do that across the whole nation becomes a little bit more difficult. So we kind of thought, well, let's focus on an area and then extend the conversations with different stakeholders. So that I think because we were in Manchester, we naturally
chose Manchester.
And just sorry, what were the sort of key findings from that more place-based?
I mean, at the time, I mean, we did that research last year, so that was kind of August to November last year. We did a survey, as I mentioned, to employers and employees. That pretty much reported that most of the mitigations had gone, but there was some kind of quite interesting results from that as well. So one in four people described themselves as having long COVID, for example, which is really quite high numbers. And of course, it might be that people were more likely to respond to the survey if they had that kind of personal investment. There were other things about, like employees said, about 6% of them said that they'd gone to work even if they were asked to isolate. Now that was a survey response, so we couldn't explore why, but the indications from other research is that there's probably you know, financial reasons that are driving that kind of behaviour. But the key thing was that it was, yeah, pretty much business as usual. You know, we talked to directors of public health, environmental health teams, all testing and tracing had gone at that point. You know, so they, whilst they were still working with workplaces, there very much was a shift in focus, as Marty said, to these other crises. Because so we've got cost of living, like the energy crisis, monkeypox and things. So they were beginning to see this shift back to look at other things, but still this kind of strong.
So I mean, in some ways, probably quite as you'd expect, you know, given the national picture, but within that, there were some interesting observations that came back.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I'm just interested in your comment about business as usual, and it is great, everybody's back to normal, isn't it? But I still, maybe I'm being over-optimistic, but I still believe that this tragedy that happened to everybody did influence people and employers as well. And HSE has been working to try to reduce work-related ill health for decades, this tragedy might have raised the issue of the fact that if you've got healthy workers, you'll be able to run an operation. If you don't have healthy workers, you're not able to do that. You can't run hospitals if you don't have healthy workers, for example. So I hope that now that we are back in business as usual, some of the employers and some of the employees will have different views around their own health and how it impacts on their work.
I was going to ask about the link here to well-being, health and well-being agendas.
That's a very interesting and very complicated question. I think in terms of ill health due to work, such as musculoskeletal problems, work-related mental ill health, for example, or respiratory problems, you know, we have been trying or putting efforts into tackle those problems over many decades, and I think, by and large, pretty successfully. I think what most individual workers want is for their employers to follow the law, and then that is a really important part of dictating your own well-being in this employment establishment. If your employers follow the law, that's a good thing for you. And have been a lot of discussions about well-being that have come out of the COVID-19 pandemic, and I'm not entirely sure yet where all those are going in terms of future research profiles. But I hope people have got it more on their agendas now. But the health of your workers is a desperately important part. It's not just safety, which is so important. It's the healthy. Workers are key to running business.
So I agree with you. I mean, I agree with your optimism.
Thank you.
And I also agree that the vast majority of employers are doing, you know, are honestly trying to do the right thing. There are some other kind of drivers though as well. We did also some work in the pandemic among, you know, delivery drivers and this kind of new model of working, which is probably, you know, something that you study here in the business school quite a bit, is this kind of, you know, AI managed platform working. And, you know, in a sense, a lot of those kind of workers are not employed, so they don't have the same right as an employer, and that sector is increasing, right? So that will provide us with particular problems, because there's no one responsible for the health and well-being and safety ish and, you know, there are maybe some cases that have appeared where you know, argued that the people who provide the work should have some responsibility, but still it's less than if you have a proper. And what you also kind of mentioned the case about, you know, financial compensation if you're off work and can't work, that makes things a little bit difficult. And that's not necessarily saying that the employers are doing this, you know, are doing this kind of on purpose, but this is a growing area of the economy where it will be more challenging, I think, to address certain issues in that sense.
I agree with both of you, because I sit in the middle. But I mean, that links into the precarious work, doesn't it? And the drivers of behaviour. So what is it that drives our behaviour? So if we take an example of, like, would I take a COVID test if I thought I experienced symptoms? And the answer to that probably depends, well, what are the ramifications of that test? So if I, as an employee of the university, take a test and it's positive, I know that I can say to the university, I can't come in, I'm going to stay at home. And I would be fully supported in that. And that's brilliant. And those are, that's what David is alluding to in terms of we've got this wider awareness.
Yeah.
But Marty's absolutely right. There are a huge amount of numbers of people who are working in employment conditions that don't support that. You know, to the extent that there is no support for kind of health related absence, that there is no salary that's going to be paid. In a lot of cases, there's no employer.
Yeah.
You know, if you're working on the platform work, gig-based work, quite often, you've just got to make your own decisions. And if your decision is, do I feed my family or do I isolate? Then that's a very difficult decision.
So for those people who are in precarious work, it's another thing. Almost another thing they've got to sort of worry about.
There were some things that the government tried to do.
Yeah.
You know, at the peak of the pandemic, to provide some financial support to allow people to make decisions, for the public good. But obviously, a lot of that has ended now, and it can't last forever. I'm not arguing it should, but you know, we need to recognise that these different drivers of behaviour exist. And maybe think about how we might address those if we're faced with a similar emergency.
There seems to be a sort of bit of confusion around, you know, somebody, you know, people know what to do now. You know, now because everything's now okay, business as usual to a degree. But you know what I mean? Some people are sort of confused if they are. If you test positive, what do I do?
do I
go into work?
Or do I even test?
Who tests anymore?
You know, but it, and again, that maybe is driven a little bit by the employer. To some extent, it's not government driven anymore, you know, but it might be driven by the employer. So depending on what your work is, and that can go in both directions, can't it? So it can be driven to sort of.
But it's not that many employers that require testing anymore.
I was just going to agree with my colleagues because I ultimately am a diplomat, aren't I?
ATC
recognises that the world of work is changing, has changed, is changing even more rapidly, and there are always going to be examples of fantastic practice, and there are always going to be examples of where practice needs to improve, and there's going to be a lot of individuals in precarious employment, and Michael Marmot has identified this already. Work is good for you, but it's only good work that's good for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's collectively what we should be trying to push forward now. Improving the lot of those who don't have good work.
Yeah.
You brought nice onto a question I had, which was that from an HSE perspective, what's the value of being of Protect to you as a regulator?
So HSE is a complicated organisation. It has regulatory functions and it has policy functions and it has science functions. And it was John Remington, one of the ex-chief executives of HSE, that put those together to make a triangle. And you say you can't deal with one without having the other two. So as the science from Protect was getting fed into HSE members of staff such as myself or our chief scientific advisor, the policy function within HSE and there were dedicated policy people within HSE who were just dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, but also the regulatory function, we were all meeting together initially on a daily basis. So what we were real-time gaining from Protect and the other national core studies, we were automatically feeding straight into our policy advisors and automatically feeding into our regulatory function, which the bottom line means people going out and inspecting workplaces and so on.
Mm.
I think there's a sort of wider personal benefit from it that, as Sheena's already alluded to, that we managed to not in 100% crack this problem because it's so complicated, but we got a bunch of people together who were highly able, who otherwise had day jobs that were nothing, didn't look anything like this before the pandemic, and they worked together extremely effectively because it was on about a single mission, and of course there was funding there. And what I'm thinking now is, can't we replicate that model to solve some of the other major health and safety problems in the workplace, because there are others that we could use a similar technique to crack those.
Which is very neatly onto the legacy of this work, isn't it? But as a regulator, mentioned before, the real time research, I'm really interested in that because that's fascinating. And you know, as you mentioned before, you know, the standard time frame for academic papers is many years, and you know, rightly so, because of the amazing work that goes on. But you know, to me, this point about real time research is interesting, isn't it? And can there be more of that?
One's always going to be a bit careful, haven't you? Because there is a process of peer review, which is there for a reason to make sure that researchers aren't just making ridiculously outrageous statements which wouldn't be backed up by people in the same area. But we were able to feed in you know, for example, findings from the transport sector. If one of HSC members of staff was going to a meeting, we would brief those individuals about findings today from the Protect study. And I think it helped them, and it helped the other members of those higher level meetings to have real world data coming in at their fingertips, rather than trying to best guess what was going on in the community. So
yeah.
I think that worked really well. And it could work really well in the future also for other issues, I think.
We haven't really touched on data and reviews, but that would be another podcast in itself, wouldn't
yeah.
it? In fact, we had an event here the other night about data in the healthcare system, and it was, these sort of issues came up, actually.
I'm a clinician, and what I believe, and I know Martin and Sheena also agree, what we have historically maybe lacked is fantastic quality data on health, and in the same data set, fantastic quality data on occupation. Because then we can really start to make inference about the effect, the true effect in big populations of work on health and health on work.
Mm-hmm.
And without going into the detail now, because we haven't got time, there are a few little projects, including one that Marty's running here in Manchester, looking at how we link data together better in the future. Because everybody realised they're sitting on gold mines in terms of their data, but we probably should start to sew these data sets together a little bit to be much more effective.
Yeah.
Exactly, one legacy will be looking at more data. Yeah,
and I think I wanted to pick up on that. It kind of links in. I think one of the real legacies from a research perspective is this kind of interdisciplinary teams. You know, this I've never worked like this before across such a wide range of different disciplines. So it was fast paced. It was brought in people from all over. It was sharing data, it was sharing information, sharing research methods, and really with that focus on one problem. You know? So I think the legacy for me is going, look at what we can achieve.
Yeah.
You need the money, obviously.
Yeah.
That the money is really helpful to fund it. But the ability to actually really approach something in a targeted way across disciplines it's been a really fascinating project.
We haven't mentioned the scale of because what we mainly talked about was
a little bit of
what we did in Manchester. I mean, I believe there were 150 researchers involved in this Protect across the UK. So from
various
universities, from both not only universities but also public research institutes. So it was, and I think that was also really interesting to kind of work across. The scientists working for regulatory bodies with the kind of universities and academics and a private consultancy kind of institutes that do research. So it was really highly unusual, and I think that's one of the legacies. We if we want to kind of solve mental health in the workplace, that's what we need to do.
Well, I think right, 150-200 researchers who by and large, we'd never really met each other.
Mm,
I mean, I had met Sheena before the pandemic, but actually we did meet a few times, and we had conferences where all of us, initially virtually, and then we had a couple of face-to-face conferences through the pandemic when it was permitted. And some of us would have written papers which had been finalised and published with researchers we'd never met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was sort of, that's what you look like, that's how tall you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
But actually we knew them really well.
Mm,
but
yeah.
So, just it totally, totally changed the way that researchers were working, that I had ever worked in my life.
I think that's a really good point, because I think you forget, don't you? We're kind of so used to Teams meetings now, aren't we? But there's this whole research project when it started in 2020, we were all at home.
Yeah.
All right, so we were working in a different way to how we'd worked before. Previously, you'd have had physical meetings. You know, you might have had a Skype meeting or something like that.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, we were doing this collaboratively, virtually, and it was successful, and we can move forward with it.
Well, I think we could probably talk for much longer, but I think our time is up. But can I just thank you all, David, Sheena, and Marty, for a fascinating discussion, and we'll have to come back out. Have a day to talk and see what the legacy of the Protect what it is.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.